Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Mike Cutler. Always good to join you at the end of a week, and boy, what a week this has been. For those of you old enough to remember, that was the week that was. Wonderful singer, beautiful gal by the name of Nancy Ames used to sing a song, and the central theme was that was the week that was, and this certainly was one of those unbelievable weeks on so many levels. And we're going to get into some of that stuff, but let me start out by reminding all of you, if you're familiar with me and the program, you know that I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Certainly, immigration is in the news today and will remain in the news for the foreseeable future if only we could get journalists to cover it the way they should. Ever since 9/11, I've taken my show on the road in a manner of speaking to try to provide the perspectives that I acquired during my 30-year career. If you want to learn a little bit more about me and perhaps you're not familiar with who I am, please go to a couple of websites. Let me start out by suggesting michaelcutler.net. That's one word, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. I'm also very pleased and proud to tell you that for a number of years I've been a senior fellow with a terrific organization known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. They're based out of beautiful downtown Santa Barbara on the West Coast. I've been there a number of times. Always a real joy to be there. Hopefully I will get back there soon. But no matter, they are focused on the impact of immigration in California, but in point of fact, as California goes, especially on this issue, so goes the rest of the country. They have been beating the drum for quite some time, trying to alert fellow Californians and Americans that by not securing our borders or by not enforcing our immigration laws, we as a nation and we, the Americans, we the people, will be paying hell over that failure or those failures. Finally, I have a new website, one I'm very enthusiastic about. It's called talkborder.com, one word, TalkBorder. And this is a website where I not only post commentaries that I've been writing, as I do on the CAPS website. And by the way, the CAPS website is capsweb.org for Californians for Population Stabilization. But on talkborder.com, we also post video interviews that run around 24 minutes. One of my most recent was with a tremendous man in Washington by the name of Lou Barletta, Congressman Barletta. I had the privilege of working with him when he was Mayor Barletta, mayor of a town in Pennsylvania, Hazleton, where when he attempted to enact immigration ordinances to fill the void created by the federal government under the prior administration, the Bush administration, when it failed to enforce the immigration laws, and Mayor Barletta saw the result. Violent crime had gone up dramatically. There were shootings. There were drug sales. And this isn't about vilifying immigrants, by the way, folks, but it is about taking a common sense approach to the immigration laws and why we have borders in the first place. Simply stated, we have borders and immigration laws to protect American lives and to protect American jobs. You wouldn't know it by the Bush administration, and you certainly would not know it under the Obama administration, where President Obama has stated that he now intends to seek to give employment authorization to aliens up to age 30, although he calls them children. I mean, it's a remarkable deal. He talked about prosecutorial discretion. I said that it was prosecutorial deception in an article I wrote for Fox News Latino, and indeed it is deception. We will probably, if he gets away with this, wind up giving millions of alien workers who should not be in our country employment authorization, placing them on an equal footing with lawful immigrants and U.S. citizens who cannot find jobs, who are unable to support themselves and their families, and in many cases are losing their homes to foreclosure. It's not just about the unemployment rate, and that number, of course, is a fantasy. Also, if you believe that it's only about 8%, then boy, do I have a fence to sell you. It's probably double or perhaps triple that because there's so many people who've given up looking for work and so forth. So these are the issues I generally focus upon. But let's get back to one basic premise, why I do this radio program and why I have gotten involved with TalkBorder.com and Magazine. It's the idea of providing the information that the news media absolutely does not provide the way that they really should. You know, the First Amendment doesn't only deal with freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, certainly it's there. But it's also about the right to seek redress of grievances and the right to peaceably assemble, because the Founding Fathers understood that if we were to have a successful democracy, if this experiment, as America has often been referred to, was to be successful, that Americans needed to be able to get together and discuss and perhaps argue, debate various perspectives so that we could arrive at consensus, so that we could work together, as they say in our founding papers, to perfect, create a more perfect union. And journalism is that fourth estate. You know, we have the three pillars of our government, the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. Well, let's be real honest about this, folks. Without an informed electorate, you cannot truly have a democracy. So joining me today is an amazing gentleman. I'm waiting for him to call in, and he should be shortly, by the name of Martin Seiff, S-I-E-F-F. He is a journalist with decades of experience. Interesting guy. He's been all over the world covering all the major stories for a number of news organizations. Currently, he's with The Globalist, previously with UPI. But when he calls in, I will let him tell you about his background, about his new book, and where I met Martin, interestingly enough. He and I are both speakers who very often are called upon by Alan L. Freed Associates to participate in seminars for various government agencies, and Martin was one of the speakers, one of the presenters, as I was in Dayton, Ohio, just about a week and a half ago. We bumped into each other, and I was so enthralled with his approach to public speaking and explaining the world through his eyes as a journalist who's been there and seen it up close and in person, that I thought, my gosh, this is a guy that I really need to get on my program. So as soon as he calls in, we will go to him. But meanwhile, I just want to quickly go over a couple of quick points. Number one, think about what has now happened, the follow-up to Mr. Obama saying that he would give unknown millions of illegal aliens. He claimed 800,000, the Pew Hispanic Center put the estimate at 1.4 million, said that, you know, they would give these people employment authorization, even though there's no way of knowing who they are. There's no way of determining when they got here, because you're going to see booming business in the creation or sale of high school transcripts so that illegal aliens will easily be able to claim that they were in this country for the requisite period of time, easily conceal their true identities, and create a national security disaster for us. And now, of course, the Supreme Court has handed the administration a virtual monopoly. Very worrying. And then, of course, the Eric Holder and Fast and Furious story. But you know what? Without further ado, let's go to Martin Seiff and welcome him to the program. Martin Seiff, happy Friday. Welcome to my show. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. Martin? Hello, Martin. Are you there? Hello, Martin. Are you there? Well, I guess we're having a problem with connecting with Martin. Let's see if we can make this work. Okay, I think we just lost Martin. Hopefully he will be back with us momentarily. You know, the issue that I was trying to make is that by giving the administration a virtual monopoly, and indeed they have handed the government the monopoly, saying that only the federal government should be enforcing the immigration laws, although it did reaffirm that local police have the right to ask for identity documents and seek to determine the identities of people they stop and their immigration status. Let's try this again. Martin, are you there?
Michael, I am. Could you hear me? I pressed 1.
Now I got you.
Ah, excellent.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Martin Seif. You know, the wonders of technology, I have to tell you.
Quite.
Thank you so much for joining me. Why don't you tell my audience a little bit about yourself? You know, I started talking about the two Supreme Court decisions and didn't quite get into Fast and Furious, this insanity of handing 2,000 fully functioning high-powered weapons to the Mexican cartels. But what's of bigger concern to me, and I'm sure as a career journalist you will agree, it's that it is so difficult for the citizens of this country to really get meaningful news. Is that an unreasonable assessment?
I wish it was an unreasonable assessment. For anyone who didn't know the media, it might sound an extreme or unfair assessment. Unfortunately, I've been in the American media for 27 years. I was in the British and Irish media for a decade before that. And your assessment is grimly accurate.
Has it always been this way?
No, it has not been always this way. I used to even give a lecture series on the subject. I can't even get people to lecture on now. I used to lecture on the rise and fall of international broadcast journalism in the United States. Nobody even wants to know now. Nobody even wants to acknowledge that it's fallen, but it has.
All right, now, let me ask you a couple of obvious questions, and I'm sure my listeners are probably asking the same questions. When did we really hit the skids, and do you have any idea of why on earth this has happened?
Yes, I do. It's happening for corporate structural reasons, but the reasons are very deep. It also goes into the educational system of the United States, which is not consciously or even deliberately uniformitarian, is a phrase one might use. It's not, but people are conditioned not to think in our school and so-called higher education system. They're conditioned not to think.
Well, let's go to this idea that, you know, my minor was education. My bachelor's degree was in communications, arts, and sciences. I love to tell people that I have a BA and BS, but unfortunately, I think all too often many degrees go down that same path, irrespective of what the major is. My question is this, though. Isn't it true that when you teach to an exam, which so many schools and so many teachers do, that you then take away from the kids any encouragement to be independent free thinkers?
Oh, completely. There is no encouragement to be a free thinker in American colleges. And this is not a condemnation of average state colleges across the country. It is easily at its worst in Harvard, Yale, Columbia, the major schools on the West Coast, Chicago. Economic theory and also the theory about open borders. I tackle these subjects in my latest book, which I am shamelessly pitching to your audience, Michael.
Well, be as shameless as you want. You've earned the right. Go ahead, Martin. What's the name of your book?
By the way, nobody will
see you blush if you are, because this is radio, and I've often said I have the perfect face for radio, so we're in good shape here.
Well, you and I know each other face-to-face, so you know that applies to me much more than it does to you, Michael.
You're kind.
Look, my latest book came out this year. It hasn't, as far as I know, been reviewed by a single significant outlet across the United States. Not a single one. The book is called, it's available on Amazon.com. You can see the nature of its subject matter there. That should still be a stupid title, which the geniuses at Wiley, W-Y-L-I-E, insisted on, How Thomas Friedman's Flat World Myths Are Keeping Us Flat on Our Backs. In part a diatribe against the idiocies of free trade, which has never raised up any nation in history. This is a myth that is taught in every college in America, but the entire economic history of the Western world, going back 800 years, and the entire economic history of the United States flies in the face of free trade and supports limited protectionism and removing regulatory and tax burdens off people. You have a large, flat, domestic internal market, which America certainly has, but you have to protect the manufacturers in that market against being destroyed by unfair foreign competition. Now, the founding fathers of the United States recognized this 240 years ago in the run-up to the revolution. One of the reasons the revolution was fought, as George Washington and Benjamin Franklin especially recognized, was to prevent the British Empire from crushing prosperity-making manufacturing and enterprise within the United States. Thomas Jefferson took this so seriously, he was the real architect of the highly successful patent law system in the United States in the 1790s when he was Secretary of State. We have been systematically dismantling this system. It has not been done by evil anonymous bankers or some mythical international conspiracy. It has been done by ideological arrogance, stupidity, and, of course, short-term selfishness, greed, and corruption by people from both our own major parties. It's the same principle you deal with in combating the insanity of unlimited immigration into the United States, Michael, but I face the same problem you do. I can't get on the American media to say so. I was interviewed by Russian television earlier this week on U.S.-Russian relations, and I found it extraordinarily ironic that Russia, which is certainly not a full democracy by any means, and I'm not naive about the security threats we face from Russia, far from it, and yet I have a freer chance to speak my mind and be interviewed and then the broadcast be sent out on mainstream Russian television than I do on any major network in the United States, whether it tilts to the right or the left. This is an insane situation to face.
Well, you know, let's look at it. I'll give you an example. You know, the Chamber of Commerce, I've come to call them the Chamber of Horrors, do whatever they can to bring more people into this country under any circumstances. I hate to say this, to perhaps even fleece them. I think of the Chamber of Commerce as that barker at the carnival who says, come one, come all, step right up, you know. See the man with three heads, you know, the guy that stands there trying to entice people to come into the tent so they can take money from them. And they've created this program, if you will, called the Discover America Partnership. And they went to the people in the travel and hospitality industries, all these executives, the manufacturing industries, the hotel industries, and they said, look, if we can get more people to come to America, you can make more money. And it was remarkable because President Obama went to Disney World, of all places, in Florida, and was talking in January about the need to expand the visa waiver program to make it easier for Chinese citizens and Brazilian citizens to enter the United States with expedited visas for them. And what's remarkable, and you know my background as an INS agent, I testified before congressional hearings on the nexus between national security and immigration, provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. Visa Express was identified as one of the huge gaps in the system, that aliens from certain countries, sponsors of terrorism, mostly in the Middle East, were able to simply hand the passport over to a travel agent. They'd get a box of those passports together, walk them over to the State Department at an embassy or consulate. They'd run the names in the passports against a database. If the name did not show up as being a suspected terrorist or a prior deport or criminal, they gave the person a visa. No interview, no nothing. And so 9/11 Commission looked at that flawed process and said, you got to tighten up on the visa process. Now, what's remarkable, and I don't know if you know this, but Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, the guy that tried to bring down an airplane just weeks after 9/11 by secreting bombs in his shoes.
I remember the case.
Yeah, he was a British national. Richard Reed did not need a visa to get on board that airplane. Back then, 26 countries participated in this insane visa waiver program. Well, we've learned that you can hide bombs in your shoes, so now we have to take our shoes off. And in fact, when I fly, I generally wear a favorite pair of loafers so I don't have to bother with laces, because our government knows bombs can be concealed in your shoes. They now, of course, know you can conceal bombs in your underwear. I'm still waiting for the TSA wedgie. That's probably coming soon. But the fact that terrorists could enter an airplane without first getting a visa has not only not been addressed, but when Reed did it, 26 countries were involved with the visa waiver program. We're now up to 36 countries. At the behest of the Discover America partnership. Apparently they forgot that Al-Qaeda has discovered America. What say you?
I agree with you completely. History shows that no great nation or civilization that did not guard its own borders ever survived. an entire society suffered total extinction, and usually rapidly within 20 to 50 years of the total open doors policy being applied. This applied to the Roman Empire in the 4th century. This is why Western civilization collapsed into a dark age.
So why is it that these allegedly learned people would do what they're doing when there clearly are previous, if you want to use the term, experiments that ended badly? I mean, how many times do you have to stick your finger into a flame before you get the message that, well, maybe you don't want to set fire to your hand?
There was a poem by Rudyard Kipling, and during World War I he wrote this. Kipling was a British imperialist and romantic until his beloved only son, he had two daughters and only one son, and his son was killed fighting for the British Army in a totally bungled offensive in 1915, and this changed Kipling. And a heartbroken Kipling wrote afterwards, not just about himself, but about the whole country, "We thought we stood above good and evil, others might fall, not us." That is what has happened here. Back before the invasion of Iraq, I said to a friend of mine, the military analyst William S. Lind, an expert on these matters, and someone you might also want to have on your show, because Bill is very also extremely concerned from the military point of view about the security threat of completely unguarded borders for the United States and for any major country.
Well, you'll have to make that introduction for me. And
I'll happily do so.
And
but
thank you.
I remember we were both writing articles at that time. The only place we could get them published in those days was the American Conservative. I don't think they would even touch me anymore today.
Well, I think that the Social Contract, what I just wrote a 20 or 22 page article for them about the exploiters of immigration, I aptly enough called it immigration, the modern day gold rush. But you know, the point you're making is interesting, Marty, because when we both spoke before this group in Dayton, Ohio, and I've spoken elsewhere before military members, I've said to them, why do we still have a military? And, you know, that's always an attention getter when you have generals in the audience.
Exactly.
And I said, I don't mean to slight you or those under your command. I'm in awe of the military. I'm in awe of the sacrifices, the valor, the dedication, the bravery, the patriotism of our men and women in the armed services. But isn't it true that your primary mission is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible? And I said, so let me ask you, how on earth can you accomplish that very important primary objective when our borders only exist on maps and there are, as of right now, unknown millions, if not tens of millions, of foreign nationals in our country living in virtually every city and town from coast to coast and border to border without any way of knowing who they are or why they're here? And let me tell you, the reaction did a 180. I had one general come up to me a couple of months ago and say, Mr. Cutler, I want to thank you for reminding me how pissed I am at my own damn government. You know, what good would our stealth bombers do us in another terrorist attack? What good would our aircraft carriers and the battle groups that surround them do us in the event of a terrorist attack? What good would our guided missile submarines do us if we are again attacked by terrorists operating in our country? And, you know, you made ample note of this during your presentation, as I did during mine, the issue that Venezuela is playing host to Quds, Iranian shock troops in growing numbers. There are regular airline flights connecting Venezuela with Tehran. We know there are terrorist training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil. So if you have people from the Middle East who live in Latin America for a number of years, how difficult do you suppose it would be for Muhammad to transform himself into Miguel?
Exactly. In my new book, which is, that's again, terrible title, but that's the title, That Still Should Be Us. That Still Should Be Us. I make a prediction there. And that is that the U.S. armed forces will be needed, and the National Guard especially, will be needed in vast numbers, scores of thousands of our own troops, especially National Guard, even hundreds of thousands, will be needed to maintain security along our land border with Mexico across the Rio Grande.
And you know, once they come here,
they
face nothing.
The kidnapped capital of the world is Tucson, not even Tucson, it's Phoenix, Arizona. Because of the spillover of the drug cartels into the business of kidnapping. We are losing basic safety and security even in the border regions of our own southern and southwestern states on the border with Mexico.
Yes, and you know, the thing that most people don't realize is not even just our border states, because, you know, we have illegal aliens in our country who've come in through Canada, who come in through ports of entry. I've
that
often made
correct.
The point that any state that has a seaport or an international airport should be considered as much a border state as those states that share land border with Canada or Mexico.
We live in a three-dimensional world, and nobody thinks three-dimensionally.
They're not even thinking two-dimensionally.
No,
they're
not.
Thinkers.
Look,
these are linear thinkers.
The title I wanted for my book, I thought, was a very obvious one. The World Is Not Flat. Seems to be a very good title. My working title when I was working on producing this book was, I called it Unflat. Both on the right and the liberal left, people assume that we live in a flat world, that borders are falling. It's good that borders are falling. It is inevitable that borders will fall, and that when borders fall, we will live in a more secure and prosperous world. But as you know, Michael, the opposite is the case. The less control we have over our borders, the less security we have. The more we demolish tariffs, economic protection, our economic border protection for our domestic industries, the more our nation becomes impoverished. The main manufacturing region of the world is China, not the United States anymore. It is Guangdong province of China, which is now known as the workshop of the world. For 100 years, Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania had that proud title. The British had that proud title for Sheffield and Birmingham for 100 years before that. Now it's moved to China. And is this good for the United States? We pay China $270 billion, not million, $270 billion a year more than we take from them in free trade. But free, unlimited free trade is like unregulated free borders. Both of them are catastrophic to any nation. The United States cannot survive with unregulated, uncontrolled, unsupervised immigration. It's on a gigantic scale, which we have. It is inane to think that we can do this.
But here is my point. At the end of the day, don't the politicians, don't these so-called intellectuals from the upper echelons of the think tanks of the world and universities of the United States understand that what they are doing is a prescription for the end of America and the end of the middle class? Let me read something. You got to see this one.
They don't believe so. They're ignorant of it. And even if they realize it, they wouldn't care because they think it will never come home to them. They think everybody else may have to suffer for the greater good, a very communist point of view that they would all have, however much they claim to be conservatives. But the real issue is they think it will never come home to them and their children.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say about communism. I want to read something. Alan Greenspan, arguably the architect of the meltdown of our economy, when he was the director of the Fed, when he was the chairman of the Fed, 2005, he bragged about how he was the guy that provided subprime mortgages for illegal aliens. And then April 30th, 2009, and I just wrote about this for CAPS, California's Population Stabilization. I've addressed it on my website, talkborder.com. Certainly my commentaries that are posted on michaelcutler.net also have this. But here's what he said, and it blew me away. And, you know, I was watching him do the hearing live. It was streaming. And for the life of me, I can't imagine why, number one, the media didn't cover it, but, of course, you know why, and why Americans didn't pay attention, because all you need is a laptop or an iPad. You can go to the website. You can see it streaming. And it was outrageous. You know, I was so angry the next day. I was on a radio talk show. They said, what did you think of Greenspan's testimony? And I said, you know, as I listened and watched him, I was struck by the fact that I was witnessing a first, the first time I had ever seen anybody testify before a congressional hearing while suffering from rigor mortis. You could tell I like this guy, right?
So, yeah, I get that impression, yes.
Well, why don't I tell you what I really think? But these are his words, not mine, and I fell out of my chair. He said, and he was calling for more H-1B visas, by the way. And then he said, our skill shortage, I trust, will ultimately be resolved through reform of our primary and secondary education system. But at best, that will take many years. An accelerated influx of highly skilled immigrants would bridge that gap and, moreover, carry with it two significant bonuses. In other words, flooding the labor pool with foreign workers. And this is, of course, before the bottom fell out. And now, wow, First, skilled workers and their families form new households. They will, of necessity, move into vacant housing units, the current glut of which is depressing prices of American homes. Well, he knows back then, in 09, that Americans were losing their homes to foreclosure. So what's the solution? Well, get those darn Americans out of the houses and let's bring in foreign people who will live in those homes. So much for the middle class and the American dream. And then he says, and of course, house price declines are a major factor in mortgage foreclosures and the plunge in value of the vast quantity of U.S. mortgage-backed securities that has contributed substantially to the disabling of our banking system. So the bottom had already started to go. And he says the second bonus would address the increasing concentration of income in this country. Now catch this. The second bonus of bringing in foreign workers would address the increasing concentration of income in this country, and here is where you better fasten your seatbelt. Greatly expanding, his words now, greatly expanding our quotas for the highly skilled would lower wage premiums, in other words, salaries, of skilled over lesser skilled. Skill shortages in America exist because we are shielding our skilled labor force from world competition. Quotas have been substituted for the wage pricing mechanism, and in the process, we have created a privileged elite, his words, privileged elite, whose incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas on skilled professionals. Eliminating such restrictions would reduce at least some of our income inequality. You said communism. To all according to his needs, from each according to his ability. Mr. Greenspan wants any worker, irrespective of skill level or education, to make no more than any other worker, lest we continue creating what he calls a privileged elite that you and I would probably call the middle class.
Now, this is a wonderful example of projection and hypocrisy, because Mr. Bernanke and the political elite in both parties and the punditry and the think tankers and the ivory tower intellectuals in the universities are that privileged elite. And they have all shown consistently over the past 40 years that first they were very happy to see the upper working class, the skilled working class, who they falsely accuse of being the elite, be totally annihilated in this country with the destruction of manufacturing and well-paying industrial jobs, which were all shipped off to China and to Japan and to Northeast Asia, and see how long America can stay prosperous and independent and truly free after that happens. And in the past 10 years, of course, the middle class really didn't care when that was happening. They didn't care. They were too stupid and greedy and selfish, a very traditional American shortcoming in the 20th century, second half of the 20th century, unfortunately, to realize it could then happen to them. And over the past 15 years, 20 years really, since Bill Clinton took power, it has been systematically happening to the middle class in this country. So really, Mr. Bernanke is not an American patriot. He and the people who think like him are reducing the American middle class, as they have already reduced the American working class, to dust. And they are all the policies that they are advocating to maintain their own little privileged bubbles will only make things worse for 290 to 300 million ordinary Americans.
Well, you know, it almost seems to me, and I'd love your assessment, you're the globetrotter. I mean, I was looking at your bio. It's amazing. And by the way, folks, why don't you tell people where you went to college? We're not talking about a high school dropout now, are we?
Oh, in my case?
At the risk of embarrassing you, where did you go to school?
Oh, well, I have 2 degrees from Oxford University. I did 3 years postgraduate work on the Middle East at the London School of Economics. But according to the educational system of the United States, to the United States government, I have a high school education because I got those degrees before computerized transcripts were developed. And even though my alma mater are perfectly happy to cooperate and give me all the detailed information that they like, when I send them on to prospective employers, but especially to the United States government, to any agency of the government whatsoever. The GS-4 or 5, whatever they are, bureaucrats there, and even more so the even more brainless computerized systems which the government depends upon, do not recognize or acknowledge any of this. So in the eyes of the United States government and intelligence service, I have a high school education.
But according to Mr. Greenspan, that shouldn't matter because you shouldn't be getting any more than a guy with a PhD, or a guy with a PhD shouldn't be getting any more than you, even if you only had
a high
school
education.
Why doesn't
that apply to Mr. Bernanke? In my book, that's
isn't that remarkable?
Look, in my book, that still should be us. I actually suggest we apply these free, flat world, free market policies to the pundits themselves. I make the point there. Mr. Thomas Friedman is all in favor of a flat world, open immigration, right, and outsourcing.
Sure.
So why not outsource his enormously well-paid, prestigious column at the New York Times to India or China? There are a vast number of journalists in India and China who are utterly fluent in English. It's the main language of communication in India, and it's the main language of communication for Chinese business in Hong Kong
and
Singapore.
And it's also the language, by the way, I hate to cut you off, but it's also the recognized language for international aviation.
Yes, exactly. And therefore, why not outsource Mr. Friedman and his free trade open world colleagues? Why should they complain, since they apply this policy to work for everyone else? And it's very clear that they themselves are a privileged elite. They've had no new ideas in 30 or 40 years, and their old ideas have turned out to be toxic and poisonous for the American people. So why not outsource them?
Now, here's my question. Don't you get the sense that rather than Mexico aspiring to be more like America, our alleged leaders, and boy, I use that term very loosely, seem to want America to become more like Mexico, where you have an oligarchy of only a very few that controls the vast majority of the wealth.
Oh, completely. But more than that, if you look at countries like Mexico, Brazil, China, India, they protect their manufacturing. Their elites have much more of a sense of social responsibility than our elites do. They try and produce more well-paying industrial and agricultural jobs for their people. They do so because they don't want revolutions, because they want peace and quiet, because they don't want large numbers of people to drift into the drug cultures in their countries.
So now let's look at Mexico. And this is a point that I've made. Over 10% of Mexico now lives in the United States. They are exporting, mostly, their young, able-bodied men, the same people who would be most likely to storm the gates. Aren't they, by doing that, also decreasing the potential for insurrection and revolution in Mexico?
Oh, exactly. Look, in Ireland, we had for 50 years after independence, from 1920s to the 1970s, we had governments which were totally inept economically. They maintained cultural and political independence. But the only reason there was not a revolution or a series of revolutions in Ireland was we could export our people to the United States. Now, Ireland was small. I was part of that emigration. I was very thankful and happy to be part of that emigration. Irish people, by and large, when we come here, we don't join gangs or go into drug cartels. But most Irish people these days become, first of all, bartenders, then if they get the chance, they become computer programmers. We love the United States. But the principle was the same principle. A small country was basically exporting its surplus population and its social tensions. And we were doing it on a very small scale, and I'm not against immigration to America. I'd be a hypocrite to be so. I am an immigrant. My wife is the granddaughter of immigrants to this country. But immigration to this country has to be controlled by the federal government. It has to be regulated. It has to be fair, and it needs to be prioritized in directions that will serve this country.
Well, and so now look where we are.
Yes, exactly. We ignore all of those crucial principles.
Well, and you know, I wrote two different articles, or a bunch of articles with two different concepts that I think I'd love to share with you in the audience. Number one, I compare this idea of bringing in more foreign workers at a time, especially now, of economic travail, extreme travail, with the idea of playing musical chairs, and we all know how that game gets played, where there's one fewer chair than the number of kids, and they circle this double row of chairs. When the music stops, everyone grabs for a chair. Whoever is left standing leaves and takes another chair. So there's always one fewer chair than there are the number of kids. Well, imagine that game, and suddenly the doors are thrust open, and dozens of more kids are allowed into the room, but there's no more chairs. Imagine the bedlam that would ensue. Is that not comparable to what is happening now with immigration and unemployed Americans? How's that for an analogy?
Exactly. Well, right now, the Obama administration has made such a mess of the economy of this country, and of course the Bush administration put us on this road to ruin before them too. This is a bipartisan catastrophe. That in reality, one in five of Americans are out of work, underemployed, or working for negligible pay. The president is so out of touch with this country that he made that notorious remark, which will repeatedly haunt him through the campaign a couple of weeks ago, about how wonderfully people were doing and how the economy was so much better and generating jobs. And obviously, he didn't have a clue. But when in practice 20% of your workforce is in real terms unemployed, to no fault of their own, to bring in vast numbers of extra people into that same workforce is insane.
Now, here's my next analogy, because I love using analogies. You know, it was interesting. You spoke about Albert Einstein, and you and I talked about Albert Einstein before the program on the phone.
Yes, indeed.
So I'm something of a science guy myself. I know that.
I realize that. Go on.
That you are as well. But, you know, in order to study astronomy, and I started studying it when I was in second grade, I learned that you had to acquire an ability to use analogies so you could wrap your brain around complex issues that might be difficult to fathom otherwise. So I use analogies, and here's my other one. We are always told that America was built by immigrants, and of course I always make the distinction that the difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. You know, we like company, but not when they climb through a bedroom window at 3 in the morning. But here's my point. It wasn't simply having lots of people charging across our borders that made America the success story and gave birth to the American dream. I think you'll agree, again, your global, literally global perspective at a publication, appropriately enough, The Globalist, is it not true that often when that sort of thing happens, lots of people charging a border, you have catastrophe, not success?
You're absolutely right. And everyone who goes to Ellis Island needs to recognize that Ellis Island was a testimony to the importance of government in regulating immigration.
It was a quarantine station.
Also
a quarantine station.
Yes, and it also set up people to be Americanized afterwards. The issue of Americanization for immigrants who had arrived and for their children was a huge priority. Theodore Roosevelt was a great champion of mass immigration into the United States from Europe, but at the same time, he also repeatedly urged the large role of the federal government in maintaining border security and in maintaining domestic law and order. The biggest problem was not in those days illegal immigrants coming in and terrorizing the population, but what you found was legal immigrants came in from criminal cartels,
yep.
From not just the Italians, but the Irish, the Jews, virtually all groups.
Yes, look, every ethnicity. Let's be fair and honest.
Exactly.
Every ethnicity has the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And because of that, one of the most crucial issues was the federal government had to be involved to protect the majority of decent immigrant families from being terrorized and pillaged by
the same
criminal
thugs
groups
that would have got
cartels
them back home.
Yes, criminal cartels usually feed on victims from their own ethnic societies, first and foremost. That is why millions and scores of millions of law-abiding patriotic Hispanic Americans would be at huge risk if the Mexican drug cartels were allowed free access through open borders to the southern and southwestern states primarily, and of course, as you rightly say, really across the whole country.
And, of course, you know, when someone runs the border, even when they just run the border, they don't come the way Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin did. They're not here to step onto our side, plant a flag, grab some rocks, and go home. They're headed for the rest of the country.
Yes, exactly.
But here's the other analogy that I just wanted to share with you, and I just wanted your thought. So what I've said is that, you know, this argument that just by having these people come here leads to success, in my mind, is similar to saying that for an ocean liner to get from one port to the other, all you would need to do, if we follow this fallacious argument about how we became successful, would be to put up that gangplank, entice as many people as possible that we could cram into the ship, to come onto the ship, and magically the ship will get safely to its next port of call. And I said, obviously, that's ridiculous. What gets the ship from one port to the next isn't the passengers, but it's the fact that the ship is seaworthy, that the engines work, the rudders and all other equipment works, the tanks, the fuel tanks are filled, and there are competent people running the ship who know how to get it there. And what are we talking about here? That as long as we create opportunities for those folks who want to legally immigrate here and get the education or acquire the skill, and you made this point that I loved it, you don't need a college education to be successful necessarily. I think you know Homer Hickam, the guy that wrote The Rocket Boys that became October Sky, said there's no water holier than the sweat off a man's brow. Tradesmen are just as essential as professors, accountants, and doctors. Would you agree or disagree with that statement?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I have two Oxford degrees. And I regard many Oxford I don't rely on my degrees. I've never been an academic in my life. I've never worked for a think tank in Washington. I've never had a single full-time paying job and virtually nothing on the side from think tanks in Washington. I've never been an academic in my life. I think most academic endeavors, unless they are in science or engineering, which I make major exceptions for, and of course medicine, but most of the rest are simply useful and parasitic. The United States runs three quarters of a trillion annual trading deficit with the rest of the world every year. A third of that is with China alone. It's around $720 billion a year deficit. And yet we have the largest educational sector for people in their 20s and 30s in the world, and it's not doing us any good. But these myths are so deeply ingrained in people's consciousness that it's like Pavlovian conditioning, Michael. You cannot get it out. People are resistant to the facts. They have become immune to facts.
Don't confuse me with the facts. You know, I have a new slogan for the New York Times. Do you want to hear it?
Definitely.
Well, you know, what they now have on their paper says all the news that's fit to print, right?
Right.
I think that if they're going to be honest, they should say, you will have a fit from what we print.
Very good, because I remember my version of it was always, this the old Roman saying, quis custodiet custodiet, who guards the guardian, who watches the watchers, who guards the guardians. Now, if the New York Times only prints the news that is fit to print, who decides what news is fit to print? They do.
They are the self-appointed arbiters, I guess.
Yes, you don't guess, they say so themselves. But the whole point about having a democracy, a real democracy, is that there is freedom of expression and freedom of information. It was Thomas Jefferson who said that if he had to choose between a government without newspapers and newspapers without a government, he would choose newspapers without a government. We are not there now. We have a government, but we really don't have a supplier selection of newspapers. If you can control the commanding heights of the American media, which are so corporatized, and it is very easy, and you don't even have to control them because they've imploded so much, they've become simply so self-pretentious and absurd. Utterly absurd. There is this new HBO show called The Newsroom with some wonderful acting talent in it, people of the caliber of Sam Mortimer, Jeff Daniels, wonderful talent. But it's written by Aaron Sorkin, who gave us that sweet little fairy tale, The West Wing, which was a big hit for 8 years. And he's doing the same for the American newsrooms now. Oh, if only, you know, all our newsrooms need to be is liberal and fearless, and all the news will magically be exposed. But when you, it doesn't even matter. The corporate structures don't have to control news organizations in America. The people who run news organizations in America, who staff them, Michael, are such idiots that they're incapable of recognizing the news if it comes out and bashes them in the face.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
And the more qualifications they get, especially degrees in journalism, the more arrogant and pretentious and blind they are. I ask your listeners, whether they are in California or across the country, when did you last see open debate about the immigration issue, about the collapse of manufacturing in America, in the pages of your newspapers or in your local television and radio stations? And it doesn't matter if they are conservative, and it doesn't matter if they are liberal. You have a choice of two sets of simplistic, absurd cliches to choose from, which are usually put out by loud-mouthed, arrogant, hectoring bullies, especially on the radio talk shows. but on television, they're more on the liberal things like the PBS News are, or Charlie Rose. They're much more genteel. They're lower key. They like to think they're intellectual and subtle. But you will never see any serious thinkers on. And there are many of them out there, but you will never see them all, to challenge the regular consensus.
And don't you love the demeanor that these are the oracles, the true brilliant ones? And let me share one of my pet gripes with you. Have you ever heard of this nonsense of the Latino vote? If the president wants the Latino vote, he has to be in favor of open borders. I mean, you happen to be Jewish as I am. I'm a Brooklyn Jewish kid, and you're from Ireland originally. But here's the point, though. How do you feel when you hear about the Jewish vote? Is that not profiling and bigotry and disgusting?
Well, unfortunately, the thing is, 30 and 40 years ago, people in America, whatever their ethnic background, were much more independently minded than they are now. We have the paradox that the more internet information seems to have proliferated, the more large-scale public debate on our mass media and our broadcasting systems has become boring, cautious, predictable, mediocre. No fundamental questions are allowed to be asked. You are not allowed to point out to either liberals or conservatives that their views are absurd. I think that the black vote used to go, African American vote used to go to Democrats, to Republicans, overwhelmingly. It changed in the 60s especially, and it's been it started really at the New Deal, but it's been totally consistently monolithically Democrat ever since. But what you see with the Jewish vote, the Hispanic vote, insofar as there are black votes here, they are, I think, becoming more monolithic, more unquestioning, simply because this is a reflection of the cliches in the media, and people in America, as a reflection of our education system, are not thinking as individuals anymore. They are thinking in lockstep. If you are a woman, there is huge emotional pressure on you to support Roe versus Wade. You're not allowed to stake out independent positions or more subtle positions on abortion. Gay people are presumed to have a whole monolithic range of knee-jerk reaction votes on vast numbers of subjects that have nothing to do with their sexual orientation. This hyphenated approach to being a citizen is turning us, or trying to turn, hundreds of millions of people into automatons. And that's true of both the right and the left.
Well, you know, it's funny, because I tell people that in reality, think of how many people lost their lives, or at least their health, to cigarette smoking because of idiotic slogans such as Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. And I remember back in high school, my teacher's biggest concern wasn't whether or not it made sense that a smoking weed would taste good, but that the word should have been as rather than like.
You're absolutely right. Look, I enjoy an occasional mild cigar myself. My wife always banishes me outside the house when I do so. And there is a reason for this, and a very heartbreaking reason. And that is, her beloved father died of emphysema. He was a smoker all his life. He could never give. It was the one thing he could never give up.
Right.
And this was a tragedy that, of course, applied in scores of millions of homes. I had two uncles who died, who were very heavy smokers.
Yeah, my dad was one of those, lung cancer. Yes.
Yeah, in both my uncles' cases, it was throat cancer, which was even worse.
Ah.
My father somehow beat the odds. He smoked 120 cigarettes a day back in Ireland, and he was nearly 60 when he gave them up, and he still lived for another 30 years. But you know, most people are not that tough or that lucky.
Yes.
And but why did most of these poor people die such agonizing, horrible deaths? As you said, because they believed simplistic slogans. And the people who came up with these slogans, none of them thought that they were condemning one person, let alone scores or hundreds of millions, to agonizing deaths of torment. But they were making a living. They had no sense of social responsibility. And when the facts started coming out in America and in Britain and Ireland too, in the 1960s, Surgeon General's report on the danger of smoking, most people didn't want to know.
Yep.
They just, and especially in the media, the Mad Men, the Madison Men, Madison Avenue people.
But look at the Marlboro man who himself died of lung cancer. But, you know, H.L. Mencken was right, of course, when he said that nobody ever lost money underestimating the intelligence of the average American.
unfortunately, that I always thought that was rather unfair for his generation, but it's become increasingly true in the last 60 or 70 years. It seems the more prosperous we get, the more our brains, you know, roll out of our ears.
What an image.
Yeah, and certainly, the bigger heads people get, the more they imagine. And, you know, computer games, which my kids love like everybody else, and it gives you people the illusion. I think this is hugely important. Computer games give people the illusion that they know everything. They are masters of the universe. You can solve any mystery simply by going to the appropriate website or by setting up your own theories on computer graphics. You don't have to look for facts. You don't have to talk to eyewitnesses. You don't have to sift the assessments of eyewitnesses. You don't have to deal with lots of awkward facts that fly in the face of your own personal prejudices. I think computers and computer graphics and computer games are making people infantile by the scores of million.
And they're not learning how to interact with other fellow human beings. But here's something that's interesting.
Oh, not
again.
At all.
And you know, let's have you put on your journalist cap again. You know, they used to say, don't believe what you read in the paper. Now, if it's, and then, how many times have you seen trash being marketed in a store and there's a little tag on the upper corner of it or whatever, and what does it say as seen on TV? Well, look at the dreck that passes for news on the internet.
Yes.
And how many people say, it must be true because I found it online?
Oh, completely. My late friend, I don't know if you knew him, I'm sure you knew of him. He died a few years ago. He was a conservative columnist, often outrageous, and I certainly didn't agree with him on everything, but he was a fearless man. Richard Grenier was a veteran conservative columnist. And Richard, before he died, came up with the theory, there is a book called The Hot Zone about how many deadly viruses developed in the tropical jungles.
The Ebola and so forth. Yes.
Exactly, Ebola and even possibly the HIV before they broke into the human population, they really developed
in the monkey, in the primates.
Among animals in sub-Saharan Africa, and then they spread to the human population eventually because they were in close proximity. So this was known as the hot zone, where the most dangerous and weird and unprecedented microscopic organisms could mutate and thrive. And Richard said, if you apply that to conspiracy theories and crackpot theories of the way the world exists, America has become the hot zone of the intellectual hot zone of the world. But this is not. This has moved up the scale. Just as we first of all lost our manufacturing jobs for the lower working class, and then for the upper working class.
By the way, do you have any argument? We have gone. We are above that. We are now involved with more sophisticated industries.
Yes.
That was like when Reagan said that ketchup was a vegetable in school lunches. You remember that brilliant statement?
Yes.
And then they wanted to believe. I remember that there was a big argument about manufacturing, and I think it might have been under George Bush, but I could be wrong. It might have been Bill Clinton. Where they tried to declare people working in fast food restaurants as engaged in manufacturing because they were manufacturing hamburgers. I kid you not.
Oh, yes. I mean, look, I don't believe journalism is an industry. I certainly don't believe Washington think tanks are an industry. They are called this. Michael Lind, who used to be at the New America Foundation, may be. And I used to respect him a great deal as a serious voice on the Democratic side. But I lost all respect for Mike during the healthcare debate a few years ago when I saw a column from him, and he was seriously saying in an effort to protect President Obama that we didn't need heavy industry, we didn't need shipbuilding, we didn't need manufacturing, we didn't need to make cars or the consumer durables or washing machines or microwaves or televisions in America. All we needed was a healthcare system, because the more money we poured into healthcare, that could sustain the entire economy for a continental-sized nation of 310 million people. And this is an intellectual, this is a self-regarding genius, this is a serious person.
Was he drunk at the time?
No, that's the frightening part. It would have been an improvement. He was he was sober.
Stone cold
sober.
There
was a line from an Isaac Asimov novel, Foundation. About, interestingly enough, about the disintegration of a globe, the Galactic Empire. And are you there, Mike?
Yes, I'm there. I'm listening to you.
The late Mr. Asimov had one of his characters come up with some absurd view to deny the fact that society was falling apart, right? And the hero says to him, "Such folly smacks of genius. You must be a genius, sir, to come out with such nonsense. A lesser mind would be incapable of it." And that's what our intellectual geniuses have come up with. They've come up with a million different ways to explain how angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Well, you know what this reminds me of? The story about this kid that keeps coming home beat up, and his father's furious because little Billy won't stand up for himself. And he said, "Son, if you get beat up again, what you need to fear is me." So the very next day, this poor kid comes home with not one but two black eyes, and the father is appalled, and he looks at his son and says, "Billy, you better have a good explanation." He said, "Pop, you should be proud of me. I hit him right on the fist with my eyes."
Oh, yes. We have become a nation that is so proud of hitting problems right on the fist with their eyes.
I mean,
that's what we do on immigration.
Not remarkable?
Yes, that's what we do with immigration. That's what we do on free trade. That's what we do on our refusal to cut the budget. It's true on the left, and it's true on the right. It's a nightmare, but this is what America has become.
Well, let me ask you a question then, and this is for my audience and for me, because I think that your perspectives are invaluable, and certainly you've had a long enough time delving into the lunacy of what we're dealing with today, as I did with immigration. You certainly have done with journalism and politics and the whole variety of madness. What do we do? How do we fight back? Where do we go from here? You know, I always like to end commentaries by saying that democracy is not a spectator sport. How on earth do we fight back?
I think the first thing to do is to try and expand and amend the Tea Party. And I am all in favor of the Tea Party in principle, but I think the way they switched their political concerns around in this election was absurd. And they must not allow the so-called conservative think tanks in Washington, all of which are in favor of free trade, to hijack them. And if they do, ignore them. But as individuals, for starters, every time you see something ludicrous and contemptible and outrageous, this may sound small, but it has a cumulative effect.
Yes.
Phone your television station. Phone CBS in New York. Phone ABC's news affiliates in L.A., wherever the report comes out from. And most of all, keep bombarding your congressman's office. Forget the senators. They're so arrogant and above it all that they sleep in their own ridiculous bubble. There is hardly any form of life on earth that is more ridiculous and more obsolete anymore than the United States senator. But the House still has the spending power. And the House has to be elected every 2 years. And most of these people are cards. If enough public opinion was brought to bear, enough people would change course. 100 Democrats defected, as you know, from supporting Eric Holder on the Fast and Furious vote when he was condemned for contempt of Congress, because these people were afraid of their supporters and their constituents. And no, people have become totally apathetic. Keep phoning your offices of your Congress. It's not a solution. But
by the way,
two
points to be made.
Step.
You see what you did? You got me fired up, because now you reminded me of two things that happened with the Democrats. I think 17 ultimately voted for him being declared in contempt of Congress. The news in New York, CBS Radio, when they reported on the vote, said that it went largely along party lines.
That's not true.
No, it wasn't true, but that's what they do. So now we are relying, you know, Johnny Cochran, the defense attorney from the O.J. case, he's now passed on, but he had a great statement. If you can't trust the messenger, you can't trust the message. So, number one, they lied about that.
He was brilliant,
but,
man. I loved Johnny Cochran.
He was amazing. Now, number two, and by the way, I wound up crossing swords with Barry Scheck, the guy who started the Innocence Project with DNA. He represented, interestingly, an IRA terrorist I arrested with the FBI. He did a brilliant job, Scheck, and he was also part of that so-called dream team. But here is the other issue that really begs attention. When people say, "Well, I voted for a Democrat or I voted for a Republican," my head wants to explode. Because if you have a politician who is beholden to a party, then that politician is not beholden to his constituents. And the chutzpah, and I guess you know that word, is that we have
a
party
have
whip.
Too, definitely. Go on.
They have a party whip. And what's the purpose of the party whip? To keep them in line. It's like a mob enforcer, the party whip. And people say, well, I'm voting for a Democrat. I'm voting for... Hey, listen, vote for an individual. Look not to the guy that's loyal to a party, but someone who has that chutzpah to stand up to the party and truly represent his constituents. I can think of two great individuals like that, and one of whom is on my website. I interviewed him, and that, of course, is Lou Barletta of Pennsylvania, Congressman Barletta. Another gentleman, Steve King, from Iowa, somebody I know quite well. I'm hopeful that he will be doing an interview with me shortly for TalkBorder.com, because these representatives are representing their constituents, not necessarily their political parties. In fact, they are at odds with the leadership of their party, and they are deserving of every American support for standing up for what's right.
Well, it seems to me that if anyone is in areas where high crime is a serious issue, and there is so much ludicrous conditioning on this, I caught on CBS, the most popular station in America, one of their detective shows is called Criminal Minds. And
yes,
they had a show this week where the plot was that families were being slaughtered, and it looked like they were being slaughtered by illegal immigrants, but of course they were really being slaughtered by evil right-wing conservatives who wanted to make it look like it was illegal immigrants as part of a property scam. And, of course, all the FBI agents were politically correct and on the right side. Now, maybe there has been such a case in American criminal history. I do not believe there has been. I would like somebody to look it up and see if there was. These people put out these shows, which are watched by 10 to 20 million people at a time, and they pump absurdities into people's minds. And there are no longer any serious documentary news talk shows where there is genuine freedom of debate. You are allowed simplistic, tame liberals and simplistic, tame, quote-unquote, conservatives. And neither of them will tackle major issues like keeping control of this. But everybody in Southern California and, of course, the whole southwestern states knows that law and order is a crucial issue of survival, not just for WASPs, but if you're African-American, Hispanic-American, it doesn't matter what kind of hyphenated American you are. You want your children to be able to go to school and come back without being kidnapped, without being sexually abused, without being under threat from rival, being caught in a shootout between rival drug gangs.
Or being recruited into a violent gang.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I had a very dear friend of mine, WASP background, military background, two sons. One of his sons was, the mother died tragically when the younger son was a teenager. This was in Northern Virginia. He became caught up at a lower level in a drug gang. And he was a decent boy. The father was a deeply religious and praying Christian. He was able to, his son saw the better side of it, came out of that culture. But because he had been there at all, the other people in the drug gang regarded him as a traitor, and the son had to go and emigrate to a Pacific nation to get safely away to live his life from the drug gang. The influences of out-of-control, unregulated youth culture, or out-of-control culture because we don't have enough law enforcement officers who aren't allowed to do the job, is vast and hugely consequential. Hollywood does not acknowledge this, either in its television or its media or its movie output. These are huge issues, but scores of millions of people...
Let me interrupt you for 1 second. Look at what news programs have become. You know,
yes.
I've probably done about 300 TV appearances, although not of late. It's remarkable that when immigration first burst on the scene, I was doing perhaps 20 television interviews per month. I'm lucky if I do 5 a year now. But most of these interviews, not all, but most of the interviews are food fights. They have you debate somebody on the other side. Very often you find out that the person you're debating knows nothing. Maybe they wrote a book, and so they spent a year or maybe 8 months researching it, and now you've become co-equals. There was a wonderful line in this film, Man of the Year, with Robin Williams and Lewis Black, and they were talking in this film where Robin Williams plays the part of Tom Dobbs, spelled the same as Lou Dobbs. I wonder what Lou thinks of it. But he supposedly is a guy like a Jay Leno character who runs for president as a lark and because of a computer glitch gets elected, and I won't give away any more of the plot. But what was remarkable was his strategist, including Lewis Black, who's a great comedian, got into this discussion about the pitfalls of split-screen television. Because the point they made is that the public walks away with a mistaken idea that two people debating on split screen are equally qualified to debate the topic. And if I remember correctly, the example that was given was the high school dropout who denies that the Holocaust happened, who debates somebody who's getting on in years, has a PhD, and was in a concentration camp for most of the war. So you have these two individuals debating whether or not the Holocaust even existed, but to the average person looking at this, well, they must be equal because there's a split screen, so they get equal credibility. And he was talking about how that distorts reality. Could you imagine in the days of Edward R. Murrow, Eric Severide, Harry Reasoner, Chet Huntley, David Brinkley, Walter Cronkite, a split screen food fight between two people yelling at each other and calling that a news story?
Exactly. This is how far we have come in only 40 or 50 years.
What do you think when you see that as a professional journalist?
It's not just as a professional journalist. I was trained as a historian. I published books of history in the past two or three years. There's no demand for any of them, which, again, if anyone is listening again to this segment of the interview,
yes.
Buy my latest
go for it, Martin Stive.
Exactly. That still should be us. That still should be us, how Thomas Friedman's free world fantasies are flat world myths. Are keeping us flat on our backs. And my name is Martin Seif, S-I-E-F-F. S-I-E-F-F. Put that into the Amazon.com search engine, just five letters, and you'll find several other books of mine there too. But the one I really need to get the royalties on is That Still Should Be Us. And I'm not planning to publish any more books through the publishing system of the United States. They grab what money they can from you. They don't promote your books, even when it's in their own interest to do so. I used to think innocently that people might be against you for ideological reasons, but if they had the economic self-interest, then they would be on the same side as you. But you can't count on any of these useless clowns to do anything even in their own economic self-interest. They're totally useless parasites. I do believe that when Americans stop working on farms, when they stop working in factories, when they stop working in industry, when they stop working with their hands, they lose all common sense, and even their pundits, the people who are meant to guide them with knowledge and ideas, lose sanity as well. And you just pointed this out. We used to have people of the caliber of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite and my own wonderfully dry and outrageous hero, David Brinkley, people of dignity, people of experience and knowledge, people of genuine fairness and decency and sanity to deal with issues. Then we went through overplayed, pretentious clowns like Dan Rather, and now we've got nothing. It's all boiled away.
You know, I can't even tell you what it's like, and I don't know if you've done this, but to sit in a news studio, newsroom, so-called, and you're being told that they're bringing some guy on and you're going to have a debate, and the first question that you're very often asked is, are you comfortable disagreeing with Joe Smith, who takes the following position?
Oh.
And you say to the person, well, why does it have to be either I'm with him or I'm against him? Because it doesn't work that way. And they say, well, if you want to be on the program, this is the way we're going to do it.
I was on one of these programs with that worthless clown, John McLaughlin, 20 years ago. You know,
what do you make of that shouting match?
Well, this was an example. You love this example of it.
Go ahead, I was on with two
highly serious academics who I'd known before and greatly respected. Both of them, one of them a great expert on the Middle East, Professor John Espositu. The other, Martha Brill Olcott, a great expert, academic expert, a genuine expert on Central Asia. And we were debating Charles Krauthammer's latest vision of genius, the crescent of crisis. Basically, wherever you have Muslims, the Muslims will cause wars. And none of us agreed with that view. And we were all agreeing with each other. There was a consensus. And we came out afterwards and were talking with each other and agreed how much we had enjoyed the debate. And to the best of my knowledge, not a single one of us was ever invited back over the next 20 years to appear on another McLaughlin show, because we were not having a food fight against each other. We were not supporting a ridiculous, demagogic, ignorant statement that a performing clown who appears in 400 newspapers was coming out with as his latest insight of genius. And it's no coincidence that Mr. Krauthammer was so gung-ho for us to go into Iraq and impose instant democracy and create a pro-American Shiite democracy instantaneously in Iraq. I even wrote a book on that, A Politically Incorrect Guide to the Middle East. That's available on Amazon.com, too. I predicted there that even if we stabilized the situation in Iraq, once the army was pulled out, it would all fall apart. And it has. I don't even blame President Obama for that. We should never have gone in the first place. But this was a classic example of what you said, Mike. All that McLaughlin wanted was a food fight. And when he didn't get it, and when we didn't act like performing clowns, wind-up clowns, to agree that he and Mr. Krauthammer were geniuses, you know, he never had a spank.
That's
and the
amazing.
American people, to their eternal shame, take these false prophets. In the book of Exodus, there is a plague of, one of the plagues of Egypt that destroys Egypt is the plague of frogs. And the frogs croak all the time, and nobody can get any sleep because the frogs turn up everywhere and they croak. And to me, America has suffered from a plague of frogs for at least 30 years. All the croaking voices in the media, Ted Turner basically let them loose on CNN, and talk television and talk radio are so cheap. Once in a while, there will be people like you who will buck the system and try and stand up to it. But you and I both know how rarely that happens.
Well, and that's
so
why, you know,
all
that,
the croaking frogs are unleashed on the American people.
But that was one of
there.
My major incentives for agreeing to do TalkBorder.com, because I said, okay, rather than beholden to the cameras at the major networks, I would rather do a video, even if it's not streamed, but you could certainly go online at your convenience whenever you want, just like you could go to a shelf in your bookcase at home and pull out that book. Pull out that article I wrote or the interview that I participated in and have an honest conversation. I think the American people are tired of the food fights and the strident voices and the circus clown nature of what should be an honest, serious conversation that takes us somewhere, that enlightens, that provides unique perspectives, not people being ridiculous and insulting each other. This is, by the way, is there anything less real than reality television? Talk about an oxymoron. Reality television is right up there with jumbo shrimp, and my newest that I've concocted, by the way, and that, of course, is
I love jumbo
heroic
shrimp.
Play.
Yes.
I mean, you know, people tell me John Wayne was a great American hero. I said, no, he was probably a nice guy, and he certainly played them on TV and in the movies. But Jimmy Stewart was an American hero. Lee Marvin, Audie Murphy, absolutely. John Wayne, no, he played them. He wasn't one of them. And
exactly.
People can't seem to discern reality from fantasy.
I agree completely. You're absolutely right. We've
got to stop
Reagan,
having
course,
this vicious fight.
Either.
By the way, we have to stop fighting so damn much tonight.
Mission impossible, my friend.
Well, I will say only that I'm glad we seem to be on the same page, because I don't value your opinion because you agree with me. I'm not one of those knuckleheads you were describing. But, you know, you look at the terrain and you try to make heads or tails of it, and sometimes you think, my God, am I the only person who sees it this way?
I agree.
Again.
I don't know. What can we say, you know?
Well, look, I have to tell you, this has been a delight. I've got to get you back on soon. I also want to get a video of you. Maybe I can drag you into the studio, or certainly by Skype.
I'm on Skype. We can probably arrange a studio somewhere. We're down in D.C., which isn't that far from where you guys are up in New York. So one way or another, let's do it.
Absolutely. And you know, folks, we are coming up on the 4th of July, and I want you to remember and think about something. We are commemorating, celebrating the birth of a nation. The birth of a nation that came at the expense of an awful lot of lives, Americans, fighting for the birth of our nation and the continued survival of our nation. Now, if you want to honor the gallantry of those men and women throughout history, from nearly a quarter of a millennium, who brought America to life, besides barbecues, besides going to the fireworks, and maybe listening to some stirring music in the park somewhere, please take your citizenship seriously. Please get involved in the process. And not just vote. Obviously, you must vote. But contact your elected representatives. What you said, Martin, I couldn't agree with more. I hate to keep agreeing with you, but it's true. Get a hold of the news stations. Get a hold of those people and tell them that you're tired of the pablum that they are furnishing us instead of honest-to-God news. Make your voices heard. And when you contact your elected representative, make it clear if you disagree with them that not only are you upset, but yet you will work tirelessly to see to it that anybody, and I mean anybody, who will run against them will not only get your vote, but every effort that you can bring to bear to make certain that that person defeats them in the election. They need to understand that their jobs are on the line, just as American jobs today are on the line because of what is happening or not happening in Washington and the state capitals across this country, and certainly in city halls as well. This is an obligation that we the people have. I always like to end commentaries by saying democracy is not a spectator sport. I ask that you go to three websites, capsweb.org. Of course, that's from Californians for Population Stabilization, located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. My own two websites, michaelcutler.net and talkborder.com. I will ask you to plug shamelessly your book before we sign off tonight, Martin. Where should my listeners go?
Go to Amazon.com, put in Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, Sief, S-I-E-F for Freddy, F for Freddy. That should still be us. Five-word title. That should still be us. How Thomas Friedman's flat world myths are keeping us flat on our backs. What America needs to recover its jobs, to recover its sanity, basically. But first of all, to get jobs for the 20% of our working population who don't have them, and to get far better paying jobs for the vast number of people who cannot even get a chance to flip burgers at McDonald's. There is a solution for this problem. It's not a crackpot solution. It's in my book. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for spending time with us today, last Friday of June 2011. Goodness gracious, I'm really turned around. Have a great weekend, folks. Happy 4th of July. I look forward to joining you again next Friday at the same time. So long, everybody. Good night, Martin. Thanks again for joining me.
My great pleasure, my friend. Thank you very much. I go off there, Mike?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That was extremely helpful. Let's up some emails next week and see about how we can further scratch each other's back.